supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Just last week, a transgendered 17-year-old, Leela Alcorn, committed suicide. Unfortunately, it's not unusual for this population. And her last written words were, "Fix society, please." This brought to light just some of the issues transgendered people who live with almost daily. Today's show, which, by the way, we had planned well before Leela's death, hopefully will bring some context to the issues, barriers, and feelings experienced by those who live with a gender identity different from what their body assigns them. Later in the show, we'll talk with a physician and a social worker from the Mazzoni Center, as well as a parent and educator working to destigmatize gender nonconformity. But let's begin our conversation with Leanne Eskovitz. She lived the first 50-some years of her life as a man and began her transition in the early 90s. Leanne Eskovitz, welcome to the show. Leanne?
Yes.
Yes, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
We know that for over half your life, your transgender identity was buried. You were born in Maine in 1935. And you said your gender unhappiness began when you were five. Do you recall how you knew what was happening with you?
I didn't. It isn't that I really knew that I had an identifiable transgender issue, but I felt different. And I liked playing with the girls a lot. As I grew up, people didn't realize it isn't that I just liked the girls. I wanted to be like them. And over the years, that became very troublesome.
So you grew up looking like a typical man.
Yes.
And you went to Exeter.
Yes.
What was that like for you?
It was actually painful. Not Exeter itself, but what I was experiencing was difficult. I felt isolated. I felt different, and I was living a secret life with what I thought were sick, strange sexual fantasies as I entered adolescence.
That's kind of heartbreaking. Did you feel that way much of your life, those first 50s?
It got worse. It just got worse until finally I became suicidal around 1985. I woke up every day saying, I want to die and be done with it. And I almost did.
You did. So
I had three car accidents in a row within a four-month period, and the last one was head-on. It was subconsciously deliberate, I guess.
I want to understand when that happened on a timeline. So you got married to a woman, and when you were quite young, and you had three children.
Correct.
Two boys and a girl.
Correct.
So you got divorced fairly early?
15 years after, in the 15th year of the marriage.
What was that like?
Well, it wasn't really her fault. I couldn't handle everything that I was supposed to be as a male. That is, a good provider, a father, and to go to work each day, and I just couldn't handle it. And all the inner feelings, the confusion, it was, as they say, driving me up the wall. I just couldn't handle it.
Leanne, you still felt there was something wrong with you, something shameful inside.
Increasingly.
Increasing.
It got worse and worse.
And is that when you were suicidal, after your marriage ended?
Let's see. It was into my second marriage, believe it or not.
Really?
I got married the second time and after 7 years of being single again, 1982.
In 1985,
I got married again.
Let me ask you this. Why did you get married a second time?
The first time?
No, the second time to a woman.
She asked me to marry her.
Ah.
No, but I loved her. I loved her so much.
Yeah.
And she... Yeah, I can't. I can't analyze that.
No, good. Yeah, we don't want to analyze love because it can only go downhill from there. So, you were married to a woman, your second marriage, who loved you, and you loved her.
Yeah.
And nevertheless, it got worse. Your alienation got worse.
Yes. Now. In terms of her, but in terms of myself, I just couldn't stand living what I called a living death. On the outside, people thought they knew me, but they didn't. It was not the real me.
Oh.
And so I was deceiving everybody and myself.
I don't know. I've never discovered, as a psychologist, anything more painful than this kind of alienation you're describing. When that bridge between you and the rest of the world feels broken, I mean, that's a very difficult to survive that way, being that alone. So when did you decide that there was nothing wrong with you, that you had to come out? When did that happen, and how?
I mean, what triggered off the final decision?
Yeah.
My wife almost died. She had a stroke in 1988, and she was in a coma briefly, a few days, and as I put it in my book, her coma woke me up. The feelings I had for her were so strong, I realized I do have feelings, for myself even, and they're legitimate. I'm entitled to have feelings about me that are positive, and that was an epiphany. It was a clarifying moment.
Hmm. Frightening.
And it wasn't long. Poor thing, she gets out of her illness, and what does she find? A husband who wants to be a woman.
Great. So that must have been interesting for her. Leanne, you're still married to...
Oh, yes.
...to this...
I'm grateful. I love her. We get along. We're married friends now, I guess you call it.
How so? Yeah, well, you are attracted to women. She's still attracted to men.
Yeah, she likes men and I like women. But given our age now, it's quite not as crucial.
I want to understand something, and this just comes as a psychologist and a human, and if it's too personal, please don't answer. But I wonder about the level of physical affection between the two of you. Do you hug? Do you?
Well, that's... Yeah, she's straight, and I always say I'm crooked.
No, you were crooked the first half of your life.
No,
or
but
you felt it.
I'm a lesbian, actually. I finally realized I still love women, but I love her, and we are not sexually intimate like two lesbians.
Right.
She's not a lesbian.
Right. But I wasn't wondering about sexual intimacy. I was wondering about skin contact. I was wondering about hugging. Putting your arms around each other while you watch a movie.
Can't get enough.
Ah, okay. All right.
We just love being together. We hug. And
good. Okay. I was feeling a little worried about that.
No, don't worry.
You know, we all need human touch. I want to loop back to something, Leanne, and that's your children. And after you had your surgery, when did you have your surgery? What year?
2001. One day before our 19th wedding anniversary. Oh, boy. But that's what it was. It was May 19th of 2001.
What was it like?
You mean coming out of it? Or?
Well, first when you came out, I wonder what it was like. Yeah, you've got a story about a bank teller.
I say that again.
When you came out, you've got a story about a bank teller that you came out with a bank teller. You were talking with a bank teller. You don't recall that story, but you said, or the bank teller said,
that's when I came out to the world. That was 1994, and I was half the time Leanne and half the time. See, her stroke was in 1988, and that's when I really came out to her and joined a support group. So I was privately cross-dressing, or I was publicly going out once a month to this meeting. But to the world, I came out basically in 1994. And that came about because I'd go to the bank once a week or whatever, and the teller knew me sometimes as Lionel, sometimes as Leanne. Finally, he said, "Look, make up your mind. Are you Leanne or are you Lionel?" I was embarrassed. I decided then and there, it's Leanne, and it's how it happened.
Well, you know, thank God for bank tellers, and I'm not thrilled with just banking online. You know, meet people. We've got to end in just a minute, but I want to ask you about your children, the two boys and a girl. What's your relationship like with them since you've had the surgery?
Well, I have happiness and unhappiness there. My two sons, I have not seen them. I don't know, maybe in 10 years. I never went to their weddings. I've never met two of my grandchildren by one of them. And the one who has the children dropped my last name and has really basically disowned me, doesn't want anything to do with the name Etzkovitz. So that's sad. And I, my first son, remarried. I've never met his wife, and I haven't been to any of the weddings. I have a daughter, and she lives only a half hour from me here. And she has two daughters, and that's a wonderful situation.
And you've got a good relationship with her.
Yeah. In fact, my ex-wife and my wife love or like each other an awful lot.
Oh, that's sweet. That's sweet.
And so we all go to birthday parties and everything together.
Sweet.
Jewish holidays.
Thank you for ending this on a very sweet note.
Yes.
Leanne Etzkovitz, thank you so much for joining
for
us today
and
sharing your story. Leanne Etzkovitz is a marriage and family therapist specializing in LGBT issues. She's written about her own transgender journey in two books, An Inner Roadmap to Gender Transformation and Let the Dandelions Grow, A Poetic Portrait of a Transsexual Journey and the Human Condition. We're going to take a short break now, and when we return, we're going to hear from Dr. Rob Wynn and social worker Elaine Dutton from the Mazzoni Center. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Supporting WHYY, Intervention Associates, a nonprofit Quaker-based organization, provides care management and guardianship services for people of all ages. Services include home care, community services, crisis intervention, and patient advocacy. Intervention Associates navigates all available health care options and medical benefits. Clients receive a professional needs assessment and detailed care plan. Details available at interventionassociates.org.
Journalist Steve Brill had written an award-winning investigation into the high cost of health care when he needed expensive heart surgery and became a patient himself. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with him about trying to understand his own inflated and confusing hospital charges and about his new book, America's Bitter Pill, on the making of the Affordable Care Act. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the transgender journey, actually. I'm grabbing a quote from our previous guest's book. We're joined here in the studio with Dr. Rob Wynn, who's the medical director at the Mazzoni Center here in Philadelphia, and Elaine Dutton, social worker and trans clinical service coordinator at the center. So I want to welcome both of you for coming to the studio and joining us today.
Thanks for having us, Dan.
Thank you.
So, Elaine, I'll start with you. We just heard Leanne's story, who was born in 1930s, and what life was like for her. You run the program for pediatric and adolescent services. So tell us, what were things like in the 50s, and what are they like now?
Well, I will say that in my experience, I've spoken with some older patients who have a similar narrative, and of course there is no one singular transgender narrative, but I've spoken with older patients who come in and say, you know, I finally found the language as an older person because there are more conversations happening now. And many of our younger patients who are in the PACS program, Pediatric and Adolescent Comprehensive Transgender Services program, you know, these conversations were happening earlier for them because of the visibility that we see now. The internet being an incredible resource for folks, for example.
How so?
Well, for example, one patient I met with recently, you know, said, you know, I talked with them about, you know, how did they come to understand something was going on? What was, you know, how did they realize something was different about them and find the language for that, you know, the term transgender, for example. And they simply said, Google, you know, I Googled. I am a boy, but I feel like a girl. And then, you know, all of these resources came up on the internet, which led them to us, to the Mazzoni Center, and to other, you know, support groups and services.
So. It sounds like you're saying that, and I'm thinking about Leanne. It took her almost 50 years to realize she was transgendered. Could that happen today, Rob? I'll turn that.
Sure. I mean, I think it does happen today. I think right now we're talking about this on the radio. You can see it on television. You can certainly Google it in the privacy of your own home so that people have a lot more opportunity to find this information out. But it also takes somebody being supportive and understanding that might be okay for them. So for Leanne's example, she did what she was supposed to do. Those are her quotes of getting married, having children, because that's what was supposed to happen, even though it didn't feel right, but she didn't sound like she had anyone in her life who could tell her otherwise. Mm-hmm. And it took her 50 years to find that strength.
So who comes to the Mazzoni Center and what brings them there? And let's start with the younger people. So I'll turn to you, Elaine. Who comes to your services and what brings them there?
Our younger trans patients come to get support, emotional support, medical care. We are, one of the things that's very exciting about our PACS program is that we are prescribing puberty suppressing medications for young transgender identified kiddos so that they can sort of continue to explore their gender identity, let it develop, and put things on hold as far as the development of secondary sex characteristics that don't match their gender identity.
Well, that brings up a question in my mind. I want to turn to you, Rob, and that's diagnosis here. So is someone who says they feel like they're transgendered, do we assume they're transgendered? Because I can see that being difficult either way.
So what's interesting about that is all people go through sexual identity development very early. Leanne even sort of mentioned it, that when she was a little girl, she thought, oh, I'm a little girl, I'm going to do little girl things. Somebody in her life told her that wasn't appropriate and she needs to do something else, and so she followed that lead. But we all develop that very early on, and depending on who you have in your life who might be supportive, that can then be supportive. The thing about being a transgender person is it is a consistent and persistent feeling that the gender that you are now is not the gender you were born with. Different than everyone who goes through a small phase of a day, a week, or whatever, where they say they're a different gender or some other thing or some animal. It's just something very short-lived. This is something very persistent and consistent. That diagnosis, of course, has to occur in the context of people who know what they're talking about. And so for most family docs or pediatricians, they aren't very familiar with this concept, and they may not address this if the parent brings it up or address it as a phase.
So you're comfortable if someone comes to you, and I'm addressing this to, I guess, both of you, you're comfortable with your assessment and putting them on puberty, what was the language?
Suppressing
medication.
So another important thing to remember is that anyone before the age of puberty, it's not even about hormones. It's about who they think they are. They haven't hit puberty, so they are not going to be put on anything to either suppress or support a puberty. It's the teenage years during puberty where that becomes a very important issue. And of course, for most trans people in this country, it's something that happens well after puberty. So they've already gone through puberty, and we are trying to reverse some of the effects of their puberty that they had already.
I want to bring up an issue here that can be uncomfortable, and that's language. Uncomfortable for me. So it's what I feel when I do my research here, and I hadn't before we prepared this show, is I felt not unlike I did in the late 60s, in the early stages of the women's movement, when I was sympathetic, you know, supportive of the women's movement, but I was so scared of my language because I could catch hell if I said the wrong word at the wrong time to the wrong woman. And you know, I don't want to be hurtful, you know, so help me with language here.
I think that's a very valid point. So much of the language we use is gendered, you know, in the way that we even say, hey, guys, how's it going? Or hello, ladies. I think being mindful of those, you know, very, very simple gendered words that are so prevalent and trying to keep those at bay.
And then coupling that with with honoring a person's chosen gender pronouns. So we, even at Mazzoni Center, even though we're supposed to be very open, we always have to ask, how do you want us to refer to you? Is it with male pronouns? Is it with female pronouns? And that seems very unnatural for most people because they don't think about doing that. You sort of make a judgment by looking at someone and saying, you're a man, I'm going to refer to you as he. And that's not always true. For most trans people, they wind up being so isolated, they don't often fight back about that. But it's very easy to say to someone you don't understand them by calling them the wrong pronoun. So we try as best as we can not to use pronouns, and that sort of gets around that issue.
I, you know, being a quadriplegic, I'm on the other side of that, and people don't know what to call me, and, you know, they're anxious, and they fumble, and, you know, they're not able to ask the question, what should I call you? And I would imagine it's the same, you know. How do you ask somebody, what should I call you? That's quite an uncomfortable question, and to be on the receiving end of that question, it's a relief.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's precisely the point. It's what I teach when I teach medical students, is that for as much discomfort as it gives you to ask the question, most patients who don't know what you're talking about won't say anything in response.
Right.
And someone who does know what you're talking about will be very relieved that you asked.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to understand these labels that we've been throwing around here. We've been talking about transgender, transsexual, and transsexuals, not just people who've had sexual conversion therapy. I am learning, I hope I'm right, and it has nothing to do with sexual orientation. We already learned that. But, you know, what does it mean to be trans?
I think that is a very big question. I think it really is up to the individual to define their gender identity. And there are so many more gender identities than transgender and transsexual. So, you know, a transgender identity for one person might mean that they identify as sort of gender fluid or gender nonconforming, non-binary are some of the terms that we hear. Another person might just identify as straight up female or male and not really associate with the trans terms. So it really is up to the individual, I would say. And that goes back to, you know, asking a person, you know, in addition to what are your pronouns and what name would you like for me to use for you, how do you identify when it comes to your gender? Hmm. You know, how would you describe your identity?
And for us, we have a unique position where, you know, we are trying to help somebody with their transition. And so, of course, we want to know all the details about how were you born and what gender were you born and what was your child life like, so we can understand the whole concept. But for someone, for instance, like Leanne, she may want to live her life as a woman and to the rest of the outside world be perceived purely as a woman, and that is exactly appropriate. And so to me, she's transgender because I need to know that some of her parts aren't exactly the same as a born female. So I need to know that as a physician, but most of the rest of the world doesn't need to know that.
I want to know about Dr. Robb. I want to know about the genetics of being gender fluid, or there was one word that you just used that I really liked. Uncomfortable with your gender, just not, you know. And how much of this is biological? Is it all biological? Is it genetic?
So there aren't a whole lot of studies looking at that, but the few that are have concluded a few things. One of them is that genetics, at least as we know them, as an XY, XX chromosome, you know, male and female chromosomes that we learn about in biology in high school, does not seem to affect it. So a trans woman, someone born male who's now female, doesn't have the wrong chromosomes. That's not how it's working. So that's probably not it. It doesn't seem like their hormones are different throughout their childhood, so not something like that. But as I said before, it's a persistent, consistent, not affected by some other psychiatric disorder issue that these folks have that we can't sort of pin down and say, oh, you have this, that's what this is.
Safe to assume that it is biological.
Biological, not something we've discovered the thing, but yes, right. That it's not something social or emotional or constructed by a family situation.
And the social or emotional can make everything so much worse.
Absolutely. And for most of the trans folks we meet, if they were given a choice, they wouldn't want to go through all the trauma that they've gone through being a trans person. They would rather try to push that aside and ignore it, except they can't because it's part of who they are.
Well, in a way, I mean, that's part of what makes us human. When we feel there's something inside of us that's different, our first impulse is to hide it and keep it buried inside. And, you know, that turns to poison.
Yes.
And so the more we keep it in, you know, it's like mold.
Right.
You know, mold grows in the dark. You know, it's heartbreaking. But, you know, if you're trans here, opening up and bringing it out could be disastrous, not just on a social level, but, you know, goes beyond that even. You know, so this is what we have to live with.
Right. And unfortunately, we see it a lot with our, you know, as you're discovering your gender identity and your sexual orientation, that's a very late childhood, early teenage year thing to do when there's already a lot of drama with being a teenager. We see far too many people who come out to their parents and then are disowned by them or completely told they can't be who they are, or they're given to a therapist who's supposed to fix them not help them, but fix them. So we do see a lot of that trauma going on with younger folks. And sort of what spawned us having our younger person program is we want to have an intervention not when people are 50, 60, 70, but when they're 5, 10, 15, 20, when we can do a lot more, make their lives better for longer.
Hmm. Helping people live more comfortably inside their skin.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. That's what hopefully good therapists do also. Hopefully.
Right.
Hopefully. We're going to take a short break now. We'll come back and talk much more about this. And we're also going to be joined by Graciela Slezaransky-Poe. She's a professor and founding dean at the School of Education at Arcadia College. Well, like I said, we're going to take a short break now. We're talking about what it means to be transsexual. What is the human side of what's happening here? Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Hey, Jimmy.
Morning, Bob.
So, what's up first today?
Blue SUV. Kids jam 4 CDs into the stereo.
A new record!
Roll up, roll up. How much?
What in the world is that?
WHYY cranked up to 11.
Holy smokes, why would you blast NPR like that?
Probably to punish the kids.
You can't listen to Frozen. You jammed it in there. Now here's the BBC.
We sound like a bad episode of Car Talk.
Worse, a good one. WHYY. Every day.
Everywhere.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. In the political battle over the Keystone Pipeline, some oil producers are calling the fight irrelevant.
We're successfully transporting crude by rail right now. There are other issues that are much more important.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the human side of the transgender journey. I'm here with Dr. Rob Wynn, who's a medical director at the Mazzoni Center. Elaine Dutton is the trans clinical service coordinator at that center. In just a few minutes, we're going to be talking with Graciela Slezaransky-Poe about her son, who's trans. But I want to follow up with you two here in the studio about this transgender gene, a teen in Ohio who committed suicide last week. Her name was Leela, and in her suicide statement online, she said, "The only way I will rest in peace is if one day transgendered people aren't treated the way I was, when they're treated like humans with valid feelings and human rights." That's passionate, it's powerful, and it's heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. What do we do? What can we do? What must we do to make that happen?
So I think just us speaking today is honoring this person's death, giving voice to this for the people who are listening and hopefully will listen later, given the opportunity for people to talk about it. It is why we do what we do, why we have our doors open for any age, anybody who's dealing with their gender identity or sexual orientation, is because even in 2015, people still struggle with it. People still kill themselves. People still are killed because of these issues. And it's sad, but it definitely motivates us to do what we do.
Elaine, Leanne wrote elsewhere that her parents wanted her to be the perfect straight Christian boy. Tell us about the suicide rate when these children, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, 17, mm-hmm. are not accepted by their parents, worse, rejected.
Well, the percentage is approximately 40% of transgender-identified folks have either thought about or attempted suicide, and that number increases when you factor in things like family rejection, bullying, discrimination, things like that. So it's, you know, it's devastating. It's we see it often. Many of the patients I meet with have experienced suicidal ideation, and there was a young person outside of Philly who committed suicide this past year as well. And
more than 44% of these young people attempt suicide or think about suicide more. So do we know anything about the number of people who actually take their lives? No.
I don't have...
The problem, of course, with measuring suicide and reasons for suicide is often that piece isn't known.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the rate of suicide among 17-year-olds is some percentage, but often we don't know what the original cause for the dismay was for that kid.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, certainly rejection by family is not going to be helpful to a child's development.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of these kids are on the street, too, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the statistics for that in general, if you look at the groups of people that age who are homeless, you're talking about 40-50% of them are LGBT. So that says a lot to us.
Oh, my God.
It's not so much that every LGBT kid is going to be homeless, but if you look at homeless teens,
wow,
a large percentage of them are LGBT.
Oh, my God. I can only imagine what happens to these kids
mm-hmm.
on the streets. Mm-hmm. Let's bring on Graciela Slezaransky Poe. Do we have you?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Ben.
And I hope you are okay. I know you're in Hawaii at a conference, and it's very early in the morning for you.
That's okay. I am honored to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. So let me ask you, you're a parent. Tell us about your son and when you first realized that he was...
I wanted to say my son doesn't identify as transgender, but I will tell you how we learn and how he taught us about gender issues. When he was around 3 years old, he put a blanket on his head and he said he was a girl. This is 11 years ago. And at age 3, we thought, cool. And he played with things that are traditionally associated with girls, that we had at home because we have an older daughter who, interestingly enough, was not interested in playing with some of the typically associated dress-up customs, etc., and dolls that girls play with, and that we inherited from other kids. But my son was very interested in it, and it didn't confuse us that our daughter wasn't. We have a term, a socially acceptable term called tomboy for girls who
right.
don't conform to the expectations. But when a boy presents those challenges, it creates some questions and confusion.
Yeah, back to the label issue. So you're a bit of a rebel on this issue. So the DSM-5, our Bible of psychiatric labels, has changed the name gender identity disorder to gender dysphoria, and you argue that it's still considered pathology, which is the same as homosexuality was when I first got in the field. Homosexuality was a disorder back in the late 60s. So,
that's correct.
So gender dysphoria feels like pathology to you?
I think that we are making pathology out of something that we don't know and understand. I believe that we were all educated to think that gender is a binary. You're either a boy or a girl. And children are teaching us, and we are listening to them, that there are many different ways of being a boy or a girl, or both or neither. So I don't know if I will consider myself a rebel. I think I'm in tune as a parent with what I'm learning from my kids. And this became my area of scholarship, and I really needed to understand what it meant to be gender nonconforming, and to be somewhere in between. And I come from, my scholarship is on disability studies, and the diagnosis prior to that, when my son was diagnosed, it was gender identity disorder. And I understood that there was no disorder there, that the only, if you want, quote-unquote, wrong thing was that he made people uncomfortable. But he was a very happy and healthy kid who just was interested in things that we were not used to seeing boys interested in.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Angela on the line. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Dr. Gottlieb. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Program is amazing, and thank you for everyone at the Missoula Center. Part of saving my son's life. I want to know if there is an organized educational effort as opposed to just piecemeal. Some schools might get it, some might not get it. For teachers and parents to have the language and to know what they're dealing with, if it's even started, if the groundwork.
Well, you know, Angela, I've got a board in front of me that shows our callers, and I knew you were there most of the show, and I just wanted to hold you off until Graciela was on the phone with us. So, Graciela, do you want to respond to Angela's question?
Sure. I think that Angela is right. At this time, there are many different efforts. Mazzoni is one resource. We have welcoming schools at the national level. We have Gender Spectrum. Arcadia University puts together a conference, and we're doing a lot of professional development. And I personally, being now the founding dean of the School of Education at Arcadia University, believe that every teacher should be educated on these issues. And that's why I am in a conference talking precisely about how to create safe, welcoming, and inclusive school communities for kids who are gender nonconforming and transgender. But there are no organized efforts yet.
Let's see what the Mazzoni Center is doing. Elaine, do you want to pick
sure.
that up?
So we have a prevention and education department, and our educators offer trainings in many, many settings, and you can find that information on our website. We also host the annual Philadelphia Trans Health Conference in June, which has become an international conference at this point. Thousands of people attend, and there are workshops offered on a variety of topics.
How do we find out about that?
You can find out about that on our website as well. You can just Google Philadelphia Trans Health Conference, or there's a link to it from our Mazzoni website.
Or the Mazzoni Center.
MazzoniCenter.org.
Graciela, I want to come back to you here. So you said you've devoted many years now, over a decade, to making schools safer places. Tell us what happens to these children in typical schools and what needs to be done to make them safer. It's got to go beyond education, I would think.
I believe that education is a starting point. Kids spend a lot of hours in schools. So if we are having the opportunity to educate teachers, to rethink gender. We have so many ideas about what gender is and is not. And we haven't spent a lot of time really thinking about it because we haven't been challenged the way children are challenging us now. And like one of the previous guests said, the internet is allowing families to find each other. So it's a combination of what happens in the home and in the schools. And a way to create safe schools is we start with language. You were talking about language and educating teachers that is critically important to differentiate three key concepts that usually get conflated, which is one, what is the anatomy, the biological sex, what is the gender, how we feel about who we are, And the other one is about sexual orientation, which is where everyone jumps in. So creates a lot of resistance in some schools to work on because they think that this is about being gay or being lesbian. So the beginning is understanding what gender is and how gender is not a binary, that there is a continuum. And also allowing teachers and parents and therapists to understand that there is also a continuum of how we feel about it. The term has been used that kids repeat insistently, consistently, and persistently. Parents are also looking for a response insistently, consistently, and persistently. So we feel much more comfortable about this, that someone like who is new to think about these issues. But language is critical. The way in which we include all these topics in the curriculum, creating a gender-inclusive curriculum, so we recognize the different ways of being a boy or a girl, or both or neither, in the curriculum with examples, with positive and affirming examples.
Let me come in here, and all three of you, all four of us, know that the roots of prejudice and the roots of all these jokes and rage and hostility, the roots of that is anxiety. It's our own discomfort. So, you know, if I'm a teacher, how are you going to help me with my discomfort? Does that get addressed?
Absolutely. And that's part of the professional development. If we cannot find a safe space for the teachers to communicate their discomfort, we are not going to be able to be successful with that teacher help supporting the students and creating a safe, affirming, and inclusive environment in the classroom or the school.
Tell me how your son is now. What's he up to? And
my son is in eighth grade. He is doing great. He had a very successful elementary school experience, so much so that the principal, the school counselor, and I wrote an article about what we did that worked so well. I was concerned about his middle school, but he's still having a wonderful experience. We did a lot of professional development, and we are very successful, and we are very fortunate because we live in a school district that really understands the need to provide supports. And the truth is, just like with inclusive practices for students with disabilities, when we make all these practices to create safe spaces for children to be who they are, we are not only benefiting that particular child, but we are benefiting the whole community. So what has happened over these years, that my son is now again in eighth grade in the school where he went to elementary school, they already had two or three other kids who have transitioned genders, who are transgender. And so what I always tell my students and the schools is, it's not if you're going to welcome or educate a student who is transgender, but it's when. Because the truth the truth is, as there are more shows like yours, which I'm very appreciative that you're addressing this topic, and we really understand what it means to be transgender.
Well, that's just terrific. Listen, I want to switch gears here for a minute, and I want to address you, Rob, on a completely different topic. Well, semi-different topic. We spoke during our break, and I said I wanted to follow up. You know, we heard about a continuum, one kind of continuum from Graciela, but you want to talk about a continuum of options for what someone has available to them when they come into the clinic.
Sure. When somebody comes in who is either identified as transgender or gender nonconforming, they often come with several things on their plate that they're interested in, and there are things people know about. Hormone change for them, having surgery of some sort, or some combination of those. And any and all of those are certainly okay. And what we find, what we've found over the years, is people have differing levels of what they would like to do to be able to feel who they are. Now, some of those are limited by cost, insurance coverage, and I would say most people wind up saying they would like to be on some sort of hormone therapy. But the spectrum of what's both available that's good, cost-effective and able to be afforded by people and then covered by insurance with surgical interventions is very vast. Yeah. And I bring that up mainly because there are so many people who never have surgery and they're just as much a transgender person or gender nonconforming person as they were if they did have surgery.
You had said on your webpage that you take most insurances, but how many insurances take you?
For general care, most. For this, very few.
Yeah.
Very few at this point. And it is getting better, but it's not anywhere perfect.
Are there any that pay for this? Name names.
Sure. There has been some recent activity in the sort of Medicare world of changing changing from this disorder that used to be gender identity disorder to something that's just a spectrum of health. And we're working with people in Washington and state places to get other people to cover. And there certainly are some private companies that just say, if you look at an actuarial table, this really doesn't cost that much money, so why have a denial?
Right, right. And for those who can't afford the surgery, I guess there's help, there's counseling there that can still help them be comfortable inside their skin. Elaine?
Absolutely. And then there are grants that our social workers will help patients apply for to potentially get funding as well.
So. That's great. Unfortunately, we're out of time. And I don't know about you, but I am so glad that we've done this show, and I so appreciate the education I've received, and I appreciate the work that you do. Thanks so much to all three of you.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So I also want to thank Leanne Eskowitz early on in the show for sharing her journey of gender transformation earlier in the show. Graciela Slezarensky-Poe joined us from Hawaii here in the studio. We had Dr. Rob Wynn and Elaine Dutton from the Mazzoni Center. Please look that up. And follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And our email is voices@whyy.org. You can follow me on my webpage. There's a lot going on with lectures and courses. And I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Mr. Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Peter Christensen came in today to help us out with the phone. We are so grateful. Mike and Scott's our producer. Larry Roebling produces this show.